This evening we're going to be looking at verses 11 and 12 in the Sermon on the Mount as Matthew records this, chapter 5. Last week we talked about persecution, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, and while there are many who think that this particular section, verses 11 and 12, are actually part of that eighth beatitude, within a number of traditions, including Roman Catholic tradition, it's a separate beatitude, a ninth beatitude. And then there are some of us who think that, well, it might be a beatitude, but it might just be Jesus' kind of realistic statement that if you're one of these beatitude kinds of people, you can expect somebody not to like it, not to like you, and at some point persecute you. And while for most of us, most of the time, if persecution comes, that kind of catches our attention and makes us not feel so hot, Jesus said if it's for the proper reason, if it's because of your righteousness, if it's not your self-righteousness, but your true righteous living, then it should be a source of joy for you, because that means that you're doing something right with God's help, and the wrong that is being done is because you're doing right. Of course, the key is not to get self-righteous about it. And he says, look at the company you're in. The prophets, and I would go even further, for we who are followers of Christ, look at the company Jesus. And if we are being persecuted for righteousness' sake, Jesus was persecuted, that's even better company than the prophets, right? So, blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad. What does it mean to revile someone? Speak harshly, speak terribly about someone. You know, this isn't reveille. It's got two L's. But to revile somebody, that means, I mean, it's almost like spitting their name out or these things. You know, it's I'm looking for a word. Yes, thank you. Yeah. To vilify someone. Right. Right. Making something bad. Yeah. Over and over. Yeah. Yeah. Against you falsely. Yeah. They're vilifying you. They're making you out to be the villain when really you're not. But they continue. You know, and it grows and grows and snowballs to the point that you're basically lowering a snake's belly in a rut. You're so low, what we used to say, they're so low that they'd have to climb on a ladder to touch the bottom of a snake's belly in a rut. That's pretty low. Right? But thank you, Susan. I was searching for a word along there, and that they treat you atrociously and utter all kinds of atrocities about you that are not true. That are not true. Do what? Bullying. To denounce you with abusive, to announce you with abusive language, to malign you because of Jesus and because of your faithful adherence. If I'd read my own notes, I have another definition of revile down here. Under B. I didn't even look there, did I? To denounce with abusive language, or to vilify, make you a villain, as Susan says. To speak evil against or to malign you because of your faithful adherence to Jesus' understanding or Jesus' teachings of the law or how to live as God expected. You're vilified, you're made a villain because you are living as God expects. Because you have a deeper understanding of what it means to be a child of God and to be Christian. I've tried much more the last few years to avoid putting an adjective with the word Christian. After talking with someone one day, and then I was reading something, and we got discussing it, and they said, well, you know, why do we always say they're a good Christian or a bad Christian? Isn't it enough to be Christian? And I said, yeah, that's true. It should be enough to be Christian instead of putting an adjective with it. I mean, what's the difference in a good Christian and a bad Christian anyway? Yeah. One of them keeps all the Beatitudes and one misses one?
Yeah.
Or one doesn't keep... You know, what's, if we're Christian, it's, that should be enough. Jesus anticipated this type of living might bring scorn and persecution on his account. On his account. William Barclay writes, when a man, and I put S-I-C, is called on to suffer something for his Christianity, that is always a crucial moment. It is the great occasion. It is the clash between the world and Christ. It is a moment in the drama of eternity. To have a share in such a moment is not a penalty, but should be seen as glory. I don't know about y'all, but you know, people vilify me. I'm not too thrilled. You know, I don't necessarily take it as a moment of glory. But that's, you know, that's it. And it's really not, and I didn't write down this particular, I think it might be G.A. Buttrick or Sherman Johnson. It is not the duty of the individual Christian to find fault, to criticize, or to condemn. But it may be that his or her every action is a silent condemnation of unchristian lives. So we should be careful not to vilify others as Christians. By living our lives, it may, in some ways, cause them to understand that they're falling shorter than we might be at any given moment. And then they vilify us. But it's not up to us then to turn around and start pointing fingers at them. You ever had anybody say, well, you know, I'm a better Christian than them, or so-and-so is a better Christian than so-and-so? That whole good-bad thing? Or, you know, I heard you say such-and-such. Yeah, well, I've heard you say much worse. You know, that kind of thing. Or I've seen you do such-and-such. Yeah. I heard you holler at that umpire. Well, yeah, I saw you teach a 7-year-old kid how to take somebody out at second base and then get mad at him if they didn't. They had the opportunity to break up the double play, and they didn't. They went down. So. But, you know, but it's that when we, it's, but it's not up to us then to look. It's not our duty to look at other people and build ourselves up. That's the temptation, is to make ourselves feel better, and more self-righteous, build ourselves up by pointing to somebody else that we don't think is living quite. And we are vilifying them. So it's not, it's not for us to go out and seek to criticize them. Now, that doesn't mean that if they're doing something wrong, a wrong action, showing a wrong attitude, that we just let it pass and say, oh, well, they'll get over it. There are times when we have to approach people, but it's also about the manner with which we do and the reason. If we're trying to do it to vilify them or to make ourselves feel better, then and then we get persecuted for that, that's not being persecuted falsely on account of Jesus. We brought that on ourselves. And so, also, and you know me, I have to tell you this, some see the word falsely as a later emendation to the text. Because if you go to a lot of the old Greek manuscripts, the word falsely doesn't appear. It appears in some of the best ones, and it doesn't appear in some of the best ones. Falsely might give an understanding that that persecution is sought or deserved because an inappropriate motive won't bring the right reward. The rabbis taught, quote, a man might, if his life were in danger, break any commandment except those against idolatry, unchastity, and murder. In other words, you could lie about something to get yourself out of trouble. Well, maybe you can find a rabbi that'll support you in that. But you know, that's, if you do that and then you're condemned about it or you're persecuted because of it, that's not being persecuted falsely, because you have done that to deserve it. So if you do something or teach something or say something or act a way that deserves the persecution, that's not falsely. As opposed to the persecution comes not because you have broken the law or done something to hurt someone else, but because you're seeking to live properly, to live rightly, to live by Jesus' understandings of the law and God's desire. And then somebody doesn't like it. Why? Because they feel like maybe they're, you know, they feel badly because they're not living up to it and you are, and then so they start a rumor about you. Or they, you know, being persecuted falsely doesn't include the guy that was on TV the other week, the Methodist guy who said, "Oh no, I was just out there to help that young woman," until they played, bless you, until they played the tape from the wire that the undercover officer was wearing. Now, that's not being persecuted falsely. He immediately said he was being persecuted because that wasn't what he was doing until that was played. So, motives, etc. When Jesus says, "on my account," it may mean the demand that true disciples confess him openly. Perhaps, if we're not being persecuted, as we said last week, if you're not being persecuted, maybe you've got an ineffective faith. You're not sharing it. The world is a sinful place, but G.A. Buttrick posits an unpersecuted Christianity may be the result of an effete faith or an ineffective faith. Effete means worn out or exhausted of its force. To be persecuted on Jesus' account may not mean that we're persecuted because somebody thinks we might be a Christian because of what somebody else says. But Jesus' anticipation is, "on my account," may mean you speak openly about it. I don't mean by that you carry the big King James Family Bible and stand on a street corner and smack everybody in the head as they go by. But because when you have opportunity, you share some of the good news. You speak openly. If somebody asks you, "Are you Christian?" or "Do you believe in God?" instead of hemming and hawing and dancing around the issue, you openly tell them yes, without seeming condescending or condemning. And then if you receive the persecution, you've suffered that because you have been ready and you have openly spoken about Jesus, confessing Him. And I think the New Testament does say some things about confessing, believing in your heart and confessing with your mouth. So it's not an abstract concept of righteousness. But for Jesus' sake and the sake of God's kingdom in the world, you actually do something to show your loyalty. Now, that can be verbal, the usual suspects. That can be verbal, or that can be through deeds, through actions, because we do witness by those, sometimes even more than we do with our words. And our actions can sometimes bring more persecution than our words. But suffering persecution of any kind, whether it's being hung up by your thumbs or whether it's having rumors told about you that are untrue, suffering persecution gives an opportunity to show your true loyalty. I'm trying to avoid, "see your true colors shining through." There are so many of us who have never, Barclay writes, there are so many of us who have never in our lives made anything like a real sacrifice for Jesus Christ. The moment when Christianity seems likely to cost us something is the moment when it is open to demonstrate our loyalty in a way that the world can see. End of quote. Just ask a question. You don't have to respond. But how many people in here have really experienced persecution or hatred or vilification because you have spoken up or because of your witness?
I was sitting there thinking about that, and you brought it up, but action.
Yeah.
Avoiding. Being a boy, that is awesome. I've been just probably familiar out serving God and gathered off, here.
Right. And that can hurt, especially if you want to be friends, or they used to be friends, or said they were friends.
Yeah.
You ever experienced, and there are some who have experienced it in church from other church people.
Right. Hey, you better see them, man.
I will admit to you, I've experienced a few things, but nothing really great except for getting run off from a few apartment complexes before when I was there trying to share not tracts, but just information about a church and where they met and what the services were. And even though I was given permission by the person in the front office, the security guy, got one call that complained, and another one said, there's some strange guy walking around talking to people and sticking things in doors. And I got threatened. Do what?
Did he have a beard?
No, he didn't have a beard. Probably at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You felt persecuted. Yeah. Yeah. I. Do the ethical thing, whether it's a Christian thing or not. It may, but you know, you might be Jewish, but doing the ethical thing and that persecution. Some people get run off from houses with children present on the standing in the driveway, and they're given 30 seconds to get off the property. Right, Jim? That's true. You were further up in the yard than I was, but he gave Jim 30 seconds to get off his property or else, and he wasn't talking about calling the law either. He was talking about taking physical action.
The thing you think about, and I kept thinking about her last week, and the last time we were doing this, the little girl who in Columbine told the person, yes, I am a Christian, and he shot her in the window.
Right. Columbine and other places where you hear those stories. Yeah. Places where you hear stories in other countries where, yeah, I mean, we consider that persecution, and in her case, it costs life, but then you've got people in other countries that change from their religious tradition to Christianity, and their families put a contract out on them to have them killed. The families hold funerals even before they're dead to say they're dead to us, and if you mail them back in little pieces, that's okay too. That kind of thing, all for speaking up, for speaking that word, for doing something that shows our loyalty to something bigger than we are and someone greater than we are, and that's God and Jesus, the Christ. And yet Jesus says, when you are reviled and persecuted and evil is uttered against you on my account, rejoice and be glad. Susan, I guess your rejoicing and your gladness was getting away without being shot. Right. Not in general, although you know, some people, and I'm not going to mention any names, but there are people who have been higher up in the SBC and even been former SBC presidents and people in big box churches that have bodyguards and metal detectors outside their offices and that kind of thing. I don't think anybody's going to go in and shoot them, but they seem to feel like it. I know one who I think seems to feel like it makes that person look more important to other people and that kind of thing. But there are people out there who really do feel that kind of thing. You know, every now and then you hear about, in fact, just a few months ago, somebody walked into a church and opened fire. Yeah, and shooting the minister and other people. We don't generally see that around here. Whereas in other countries and other situations, they live with it every day, and that's a real test of loyalty. Back in the early Christian era, some of the early church fathers write about in Rome, especially in Nero and Domitian, and even the Roman Emperor Trajan's situations in Rome, all it took was the rumor that you might be a Christian to get you arrested, tortured, and even if you recanted, maybe still killed if they didn't believe you. Jim? Sorry.
Don't you think it's really here discussing the Bible Belt to get more to where people don't really want to talk about the reason? I know I've been out of Queens.
Well, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think there, you know, even in the, of course, even in the Bible Belt, we've been great persecutors of people who didn't share our religious tradition too, a lot of times. But I think a lot of folks these days don't want to talk about religion because they don't want to get in an argument, get upset. I also think there are a lot of folks that go to some of the churches around and don't want to talk about anything in depth in religion because they don't want to have to think and find out that maybe what they thought they need to revise and just give me the nice simple platitudes and keep it on the surface as I've called it for 30 years now, teaspoon theology. But I've had other people say, you know, an inch deep and a mile wide. But religion and politics are such vitriolic, can be such vitriolic discussions. And religion and politics can be so inflammatory that people don't want to get into that. So, you know, even in the Bible Belt and other places, and you can be persecuted for even considering that. But and sometimes the persecution is, I don't want to talk about it, and they'll walk away, and next time you see them, they won't even speak. Yes, Susan. Yeah, and being persecuted because of a denomination or a misunderstanding of a denomination, you know, the idea is that's all Baptists are about, even in a secular classroom, is evangelizing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's very, very true. Like, you know, as William mentioned a while ago, another Presbyterian, or there is a church in the area that does not have a baptismal pool, and the minister and I last year were talking, and he had a couple of young people that wanted to be baptized, and I said, well, come over, we'll have a joint service. And he was for it, and some of his leaders were for it, and two of them spoke up and said no, because you're going to be in a Baptist church and we don't baptize that way, and all they're going to think is, see, we got the right way, and they're finally coming around. No. But, you know, that does happen. Where it probably happens in the South more than any place else, well, it did anyway, till we Baptists always beat each other up in public and air our dirty laundry in public. I can remember growing up, and still every now and then, people will say, oh, well, you know, you don't need to listen to them, they're Catholic. I have made it one of my smaller missions in life to say, hold on, time out. Let's talk about what they really believe and what they don't and what you think they do. That's a misnomer, just like what they think we do is a misnomer a lot of times, or misinformation. And but I, you know, growing up, I only knew two Catholics in high school. I'm sure there were others, just they didn't let you know that they were. The salutatorian in my graduating class was a Mormon. In fact, she's the only Mormon I knew. But then, lo and behold, I found out not all Catholics are bad. Just like not all Baptists are bad, some are. But you know, and as I've often said, you know, but we do get that persecution, and those, and people are afraid to talk because they're afraid we're going to point fingers and say, well, my God's better than your God, or my brand of God is better than your brand of God. And that's part of why the lack of talk, maybe, Jim, is that whole idea of, but see, that too could be considered falsely if we don't understand and we don't have an understanding exactly what the tradition is or what that particular person practiced. I mean, I've told you before, the U.S. government recognizes nearly 300, the IRS, nearly 300 different religious groups and conventions for tax purposes, and there are 38 different Baptist groups, including the Seventh-day Baptists and all kinds of others, baptized in the Holy Ghost Spirit Baptists. I mean, there are all kinds of. There are several different kinds of Lutherans and Methodists. There are different branches of Roman Catholicism, and on and on. So, and sometimes maybe the persecuted falsely is we try to stand up and somebody discounts us because they say, well, you know, oh, she's a Baptist and we don't want to deal with that because you know how they are. A lot of times they can't tell you, or they don't want to tell you. And we who are Baptists of various stripes have shot ourselves in the foot or more vital areas so many times over. Sometimes, there used to be times I thought the only reason some of these Baptist leaders opened their mouths was to rearrange their feet because they had permanent foot and mouth disease. We brought some of that on ourselves. As have, you know, other groups too. It's not just us, but we're Baptists, and I'm an equal opportunity insulter if you really want to. I can insult about any denomination, but including my own. Probably more my own than. I know some people think I am an insult to our groups, but that's okay. That's another lifetime. But persecution in ways that maybe we don't imagine. It was certainly not persecution as in threatening life and limb. So there are all kinds of persecutions. And maybe we need to be a little more cognizant of the subtle persecutions that we have with other folks. And maybe we can mend some fences and tear down some walls. Walls that separate us, maybe we can climb or find some way to get around them, because I'm still on your side from the bottom of my heart. That's also from a song, but you know, to try and find ways to do that and to realize where perhaps we persecute folks without really thinking about it. We become comfortable in our own area and in our own skin so much that we do that. But Jesus said, rejoice and be glad when you're persecuted, for your reward is great in heaven. For so men persecuted the prophets who were before you. That's a rather startling statement. Rejoice in this persecution. The word be glad. Angelestai means, is from two Greek words that means to leap exceedingly or to leap joyfully. I don't know, leaping like a stag or leaping like the ballet dancers or whatever. But to leap joyfully, to leap exceedingly, is what it means to be glad. To show in your demeanor that it's okay. That your life and who you are doesn't depend upon what's being said about you negatively. And that if it's because you are truly living as you best can with God, and you're being persecuted falsely and reviled and persecuted because of that, don't let it get you down. Don't let it put you in a state of depression. But find a sense of gladness and joy in that. You stand in good company. The prophets of Israel were persecuted, even by their own people, weren't they? Like I said, Father's Day. It's hard to find good statements in the Old Testament about fathers. Most of them are, your fathers ate sour grapes, or your fathers did this, or your fathers persecuted these, and your fathers killed those. And they were persecuted even by their own people, and you stand in good company. And also, I think, by doing this, Jesus is also saying, remember that standing in that company, when you're persecuted, you're not alone. You're not alone. Christ will be with you. Others have stood there as well. And perhaps somebody else will stand with you. You're not alone. And even if nobody else stands with you, there's God. Okay? There's God. Your reward is great in heaven. Notice that heaven itself is not said to be the reward, but there are rewards in heaven. Okay? Jesus is indicating God has chosen that there be a correlation between our behavior and our standing in heaven, our reward in heaven. Ben Witherington. God has decided there's a correlation between our behavior and our standing or our reward in heaven. Whether we are Baptist, Methodist, any other denomination, isn't what counts. What counts is the correlation between our behavior, our words, and then our rewards. God also uses our faithfulness during persecution to fulfill His purpose of others coming to know Christ. Reward is not just in heaven in the afterlife, but is to be enjoyed on earth as well. It's the kingdom of heaven on earth. Jesus says that two or three times. He's also not saying that reward is a matter of heavenly bookkeeping. We generally, a lot of times, do we not reduce heaven and our rewards in heaven to God's got this ledger out here, and we do this, and or we do that, and or we believe this, and yeah, we used to have that. We called it the 8-point record system. You could track, as I said before, you could trace your spiritual pilgrimage weekly. Attended worship on time. Well, a lot of folks couldn't check that one, but on time. Studied your Bible daily. Yeah. Staying for worship. Giving offering. Read your Sunday school lesson. The thing is, there probably would have been a lot more people that couldn't check that if it said, read your Sunday school lesson before Saturday night or Sunday morning. But it just said, read your Sunday school lesson. And if you're driving down the road and you're reading it on the steering wheel and doing it like this, you know, at least you got it read. Right? But we do. We tend a lot of times to put it down to God's got this ledger book and going to be checked off or not. It's a matter of bookkeeping. I guess maybe if we think that way, maybe God ought to have a visor on and what are those things on your sleeves? Armbands. You know, and have his little adding machine in front of him. But we do that. When we talk about so-and-so, boy, they just got more stars in their crown. Or they added to their reward in heaven. God promises reward, but often the reward is actually in the doing. How many times do you do something for somebody and actually you think you're doing something for them, but you're the one that gets the blessing out of it? If we approach it from the standpoint, well, I'm going to do it. Oh, yeah, I got a blessing out of it. But boy, wait till I get to heaven. God's got even more waiting for me because of this. You just did it for the wrong reason, so don't expect anything more. Jesus avoids the danger of this because he teaches, and I'm quoting Sherman Johnson here, he teaches, A, God's reward cannot be measured because it consists of salvation and is identical for everybody. So you can't measure it for yourself because it consists of salvation and it's identical. God doesn't say, well, I'm going to save you, but I'm going to save you a little bit more. Redemption and salvation is the same, regardless of from whence we come. B, that it is out of all proportion to the services we render. The salvation and redemption God gives is far out of proportion to what we do. C, that in the last analysis, it is a gracious gift for, in Luke 17:10, for, quote, when you have done all that is prescribed for you, then you will receive. In other words, we don't just do part of it. When we've done all that has been prescribed, then our incomes, we can rest. End quote. In fact, this beatitude probably tells us more about the outcome of a Christian life, that if we live in Christ's way faithfully, we will find an at-homeness with God. a sense of being at home with God and not just somewhere out there, but at homeness here too. Even though we're wanderers in a weary land. You know, that almost sounds like being a song. But I think it is. But we find an at-homeness with God here. Even in persecution, we can find an at-homeness with God here. Because Christ still needs witnesses, especially in the face of persecution. Even in the face of that persecution when somebody says, well, you know, she's a Baptist, we just don't want to hang out. Well, being gracious instead of reacting terribly. Letting someone know, you know, that's not really fair. Let's, you know, but being gracious in the way we do it in the face of persecution. That action may actually not only give us reward and satisfaction in doing the right thing in the right way, but it also might draw us closer together in times of persecution, even with the persecutor. And that's the tough thing. Trust me, I don't want to be persecuted. Probably only masochists do. But Jesus, I think, and that and the dollar get you to drink machines up at Walmart for 75 cents. On the Goodyear on Wade Hampton Boulevard to 75 cents. I saw that the other day when I had some work done on a car. That when people revile you and persecute you, this is Jesus' statement. If you're a Beatitude Christian, people will revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of things about you, whether it's terrible, dastardly stuff or just kind of nitpicky, putting the fork in and twisting it just a little bit. Don't think. Yeah, you know, we sell people a bill of goods a lot of times when we tell them, oh, just come to Jesus and everything will be great. And when they wake up 2 days later and everything's not changed and it's not all that great in the world around them, they say, well, wait a minute, somebody lied to me. Come to Jesus and you'll have somebody who will help you through the persecution if you stand firm. And if you stand faithfully, you'll find you're at home with God regardless of where you are. Because of whose you are. Anything else? Anybody? I do appreciate y'all adding to the discussion. Thank you.
Well,
yes, ma'am. Oh, it's still out there. It just looks and smells dead to some people, but it's still out there. The ecumenical movement is there, but it doesn't have quite as much punch as it used to. Some of what's happened, actually the United Church of Christ was in the forefront as a congregational Christian out of New England and down as far as North Carolina, never made it to South Carolina or below, but United Church of Christ is the founding member and still the predominant denomination in the National Council of Churches. There are Baptists who have been very active in the ecumenical movement, as well as some Episcopalians and Lutherans and others. But there's been so much in the last 10, 15 years, so much polarization that people are afraid to get out there. Ecumenical movement from a religious standpoint. Now, there is an ecumenical movement from the perspective of social issues. There are people who will absolutely be vitriolic and vilifying of Roman Catholics. But when it comes to certain hot-button social or political issues, they'll stand arm in arm and sing Kumbaya till the cows come home. And then when the rally is over or the movement either has lost its steam or it's been successful, then they step back and start pointing the fingers again. And so ecumenism, unfortunately, in some ways, has been reduced for a lot of folks to not a religious or spiritual thing as much as it is a social. Although, that's not totally bad if we could just get a little more of the other. Walter Rauschenbusch was the father of the social gospel. movement back in the early 20th century, and Rauschenbusch. Of his, in his day for social, for a lot of social issues, Rauschenbusch was every bit as important. I know this may not be politically correct, but I think Rauschenbusch was every bit as politically important as Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement. Rauschenbusch worked with civil rights movements, but he worked with other social issues, the homeless and poverty and other kinds of things. And you know, the Gospel of Luke has been called the social gospel because there is so much emphasis on the poor and the oppressed. But I, well, my dissertation was on ecumenism, and I'm still a proponent of it. It's just I work with anybody that'll work with me, but I'm finding fewer that want to work with me from certain groups. So. And sometimes I don't react the best way to it. But that's a very good question. Thank you. There's nothing else. Not only have we run over for 5 minutes, we didn't, but the DVD didn't start until after Ken got back up there, but he told me that for some reason it's now doing all the high quality. So I guess what I've been saying is more highbrow, but no. All the high quality is recording it on high quality, so I have less time on a disc. I probably still got 10 minutes, but I'm not going to take 10 minutes. So God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.